with an interview between Jeff Sessions, who was being interviewed by Stephen Bannon, top aide to President Trump, referring to the old immigration laws.
Yeah, I was just listening to that. So Jeff Sessions, you know, in this interview you played yesterday, is celebrating the 1924 Act, the Reed-Johnson Act, or the Johnson-Reed Act, which closed the border for Jews. And I need to also emphasize, for millions of people from other parts of the world, too. It wasn't just Jews, but we know the sort of consequences were catastrophic for Jews. But it's terrifying to me that Jeff Sessions is celebrating this act that we now know and regard, you know, is universally regarded as xenophobic and destructive and baseless, and a terrible mark on this country's history.
We're going to have to leave it there. Lizzie Ratner, senior editor at The Nation, will link to her article, Nobody Wanted to Take Us In, The Story of Jared Kushner's Family and Mine. And that does it for today's show. A correction, our headlines on Wednesday included a claim by a man who told WJBK in Detroit that his mother, an Iraqi-American green card holder, died after being denied entry into the United States. An imam in Detroit has since told the station that the woman died in Iraq 5 days before the ban went into place. That does it for the show. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Yes Man Fixed the World, will play Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. The Yes Man Fixed the World is the true story of two guys in thrift store suits who impersonate corporate bigwigs and follow the twisted logic of corporate capitalism to its conclusion, exposing the absurdities and ironies of an economic system that ruthlessly rules the planet. Again, that's The Yes Man Fix the World, Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station and pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is February 18th at 5 p.m. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to the community and KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. Apply today to support your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City Council today heard testimony on a proposed ordinance that would require landlords to pay the moving costs for renters in the event of a no-cause eviction.
At today's National Prayer Breakfast, Donald Trump promised he would scrap the Johnson Amendment, which forbids political activity by religious and charitable organizations.
And we'll speak with Ken Ward, an anti-pipeline activist from Corbett, who was recently released from custody in Washington State.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 2nd, 2017. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. A rally in favor of tenants' rights took place in Portland City Hall at 1 p.m. today, followed by a jam-packed hearing for a new ordinance proposed by Commissioner Chloe Udaly that would require landlords to pay relocation money to tenants evicted without cause. Event organizers Portland Tenants United have referred to Commissioner Udaly's proposed legislation as, quote, the boldest tenant protection law the city has ever seen. The hearing at City Hall was over capacity by start time, and overflow crowds were directed to the second floor of the Portland building next door to watch a live stream of the hearing. The overflow room was full as well by the time Mayor Wheeler passed the spotlight to Commissioner Udaly, who gave a carefully worded, heartfelt speech introducing the new ordinance, during which she preemptively struck down some of the arguments that landlords used to combat tenant protection measures. Udaly also called on state legislators to repeal its ban on rent control and implied that the present ordinance was only the first step towards expanding tenant protection laws in Portland and throughout the state. Over 100 people, tenants, landlords, and lobbyists alike, had signed up to give 3 minutes of testimony apiece during the hearing, which was expected to run for several hours, with a vote expected by 5 or 6 p.m. today.
Advocates say the president's Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, is a threat to laws allowing terminally ill patients to die if they choose to. I'm Miriam Widman, and I got help for this story from the Oregon News Service. Advocates for end-of-life choices are concerned about President Trump's pick for Supreme Court Justice, Neil Gorsuch. Oregon was the first state, via voter initiative, to provide medical aid in dying as an option for terminally ill patients at the end of their lives. In 2006, Gorsuch argued against the practice in his book, The Future of Assisted Suicide and Euthanasia. However, Kevin Diaz, National Director of Legal Advocacy for the end-of-life advocacy organization Compassion and Choices, notes that assisted suicide and euthanasia are far different from medical aid in dying laws.
Medical aid in dying is when a medical professional, a physician, prescribes a life-ending medication to give to a person who is an adult, who is terminally ill, which means 6 months or less to live, and who will then self-ingest the medication if and when suffering becomes too great.
Gorsuch argues in his book that assisted suicide could open the doors to considering some lives less valuable. But Diaz emphasizes that the 6 states that have approved laws do not allow medical aid in dying for the purposes of assisted suicide or mercy killings. He separates assisted suicide as a term used when people who are not sound of mind are convinced to kill themselves. Diaz says Compassion and Choices is currently working on a case in Vermont where physicians are asking to be exempt from their legal requirement in the state to inform terminally ill patients about the option to end their life. He says this is where erosion to law is most likely to occur nationwide and could even extend to healthcare organizations wishing to be exempt because of their religious views.
It would be unfortunate to essentially allow physicians to not provide the whole truth to patients or give patients all the information that they need to make educated decisions in consultation with their loved ones and family members and spiritual advisors.
Polls are showing growing support for a person's right to die with dignity. A Gallup poll from last year found nearly 7 in 10 people agreed a terminally ill patient should legally have the right to end his or her life if requested. For the KBOO Evening News, with help from the Oregon News Service, I'm Miriam Widman.
Climate activist and Corbett resident Ken Ward's trial on sabotage charges ended in a hung jury Wednesday in Washington's Skagit County. Ward initially faced up to 30 years in prison for shutting down the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Judge Michael Rickert denied Ward a necessity defense and expressed doubts about climate change. KBOO reporter Miriam Widman spoke to Ward and asked him for his thoughts on the hung jury.
I was quite surprised. I mean, here we are. We had a jury going into the jury room, and we sent them in with a 7-minute-long video that we produced of me actually doing the things that I was charged with. So I was quite surprised when the judge called us in and said that they hadn't been able to reach agreement.
So your defense attorneys prepared a video? What did the video show?
Well, sure. What I did was to cut a lock off a fenced enclosure and go into a section of the pipeline where they have what are called emergency block valves. Then I cut another chain off of the valve, and then I closed the pipeline. And then I put my own lock on it and put some sunflowers on it. I live streamed that whole process with my phone that was attached to my body, and that was on my Facebook page. And then 2 independent documentarians videoed me also. And what we did was to prepare a short version, a 7-minute-long version of that action, which we were planning to show as part of our defense. And actually, the prosecutor asked if he could show it as part of the prosecution. So that was shown to the jury, and then it was available to them in the jury room. And we know that they reviewed it at least once. So as the judge pointed out, it's highly unusual for a defendant to provide materials used by the prosecutor in a criminal trial. And then in addition to that, as best I could, I provided both an oral testimony and in a couple of exhibits information about what climate change will mean for the world as a whole and also Skagit County in particular. So they also had a sea level rise map of what was projected for Skagit County in 2050, where roughly a quarter of the county is underwater.
Oh, that's interesting. And that was let in because my understanding is that they did not allow the necessity defense. Can you explain that?
That's true. Yes, exactly. Last week, the judge denied our efforts to mount a necessity defense. And that means I was precluded from putting on any of the climate scientists and other experts who would have been able to testify to the dire need for, the need for urgent action. And also could have talked to the or spoke to the efficacy of this kind of nonviolent direct action. So that was all precluded. The judge did say I would leave me some small leeway to talk about what my motivation, why I did this. And so, I was able to say, well, I look at maps like this, and I'm deeply concerned, and I'm motivated to do something. So it was a very, very small number of sort of data points, specific examples, but they did have a map, and they did have a chart of how much carbon has been in the atmosphere over the last 400,000 years and how much is there now. And that's it.
So I'm just curious, what was their key argument against you?
Their key argument against me was that I did it. In opening and closing statements said, people have a lot of opinions and on things like climate change, and that doesn't excuse, behavior like this. You should convict him.
So what's next for you now? You got a hung jury? Are they going to retry it or what?
We will know next week. We haven't heard from them directly, but I do know in other press reports that they have said that they have not yet made a decision whether to retry. I certainly expect that that they will, but I don't know that yet, and we'll find out next week.
What are your lawyers expecting?
My lawyers feel like I've won a point with my lawyers here, because many of us have been arguing all along that climate is utterly different than other political issues as they are tried in the court, because we now know that there are a set of people who are sprinkled out throughout society, and some of them are DAs, sometimes they're judges, and sometimes they're jurors, who are feeling like we aren't properly dealing with this single largest threat to our existence, and given an opportunity, they'll act on it. And in this case, clearly, some number of the jurors agree with that. The lawyers say, we're not in territory that they have any experience of. I'm charged with the crime of sabotage. My lawyer, who has 40 years of experience practicing Washington, said he's never seen the charge made. The judge, who has 35 years of experience on the bench and as a prosecutor in Washington, has never seen the charge made. So we're seeing unusual things happen here.
Wow. I'm just wondering if this case in some way set some kind of legal precedent for cases to come.
I don't think it sets a legal precedent, but it certainly sets a political and moral precedent for other cases. I mean, absent the thing about a necessity defense is that jurors are instructed that they have a legal basis for not finding someone guilty. I think this case is even more powerful because the jury had no such instruction and they still came to that decision. So I think it sets a powerful example. Obviously, I hope it'll set a powerful example for future juries in Skagit County, should I be or others be charged. And in fact, there are a number of trials in the next month for people who were arrested as part of the Break Free Anacortes train blockade. I happen to be one of them. So we have 48 people going to trial in Skagit County in the next month. And perhaps the actions of the jury in this case will influence those.
Are you planning on continuing with your activism?
First of all, I have to wait and see if we're going to trial again. And if so, we'll have to go through another trial. If I do that and I am found guilty, then we'll certainly appeal if we're not allowed a necessity defense in the next case. But none of that changes what I'm going to do. I continue I mean, I feel like, you know, the world is ending right in front of our eyes, and that all of us should do the maximum that we can do to try to stave that off, stave off the worst of that. I'm not planning to spend the rest of my life doing that.
That was KBOO reporter Miriam Widman speaking to Ken Ward about his trial in Washington State on sabotage charges that ended Wednesday in a hung jury.
Jesse Sponberg, who ran for mayor of Portland last year, posted a video on Facebook on Wednesday referring to a fight at PDX. His video describes an incident associated with a demonstration on Sunday in which someone punched the controversial street preacher Grant Chisholm. Sponberg said that he supported a decision to neutralize Chisholm, although he did not admit to throwing punches. The Portland street preacher was knocked unconscious. Sponberg said he was at the protest shooting footage as a journalist. He saw someone from Chisholm's group, the Bible Believers, throw a person to the ground. He claims he helped to defuse a dangerous situation, and he rejected Chisholm's assertions that he was punched with something metal and then kicked when he was on the ground. Steve Johnson, Port spokesperson, said that Sponberg had not been arrested as of Thursday morning. Sponberg had no comment for KBOO News, saying that there would be a press conference at the airport at 5 p.m. today.
Donald Trump made a consequential promise this morning at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., in between attacking Arnold Schwarzenegger's ratings on The Apprentice and vowing to fix, quote, things. He promised that he would totally destroy the Johnson Amendment, an Eisenhower-era addition to the tax code that forbids religious and charitable organizations from making political contributions or endorsements. For more on what this means for the country, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke to Emily Peterson-Kasson, the project director for the Bright Lines Project at the D.C.-based watchdog group Public Citizen.
Can you give our listeners just a brief overview of what the Johnson Amendment is, who it prohibits from political activity?
Absolutely. So the Johnson Amendment is part of the tax code section 501c3, which applies to charities and religious organizations that can accept tax-deductible donations. And basically, it prevents them from doing partisan political activity.
Okay. And so that would apply to... that applies to all 501c3s, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
I know that the quote is, you know, Donald Trump threatens to totally destroy Johnson Amendment. What can he do with, given the power he has right now with Republicans in control of Congress and so on?
Sure. So since this is a statute, it would require congressional action to overturn. Theoretically, there could be, you know, Donald Trump could direct the IRS and the Treasury Department to not enforce the laws that are in place. But I do think that given control over the House and the Senate, you're more likely to see a legislative assault on the Johnson Amendment and nonprofit nonpartisanship. And indeed, there have already been a couple of bills introduced that would harm the nonpartisan environment that C3s currently have.
The scope of this seems to be huge. Like, what would the landscape for political donations look like if Trump was able to, quote, totally destroy the Johnson Amendment?
Right. So the big difference between a 501c4, for example, which can do some political spending, and a 501c3, which can't do any, is that 501c3s, because they don't do partisan political activity, you can take a deduction on your taxes. If you donate to a 501c3, that's, you know, what most people do. So what this could, a Johnson Amendment repeal could potentially mean is that 501c3s who were willing to abuse the system could take donations and spend them in our elections in a partisan political way and would be subsidized by all American taxpayers because there would be a tax deduction for this spending.
The impetus for this seems to have come mostly, at least publicly, from religious groups who, you know, for years and years, basically since it passed, have been saying that it's a violation of their First Amendment rights, you know, for preachers to speak out politically in the pulpit and so on. Do you know the 501c3s cover, you know, everything from the Legislative Exchange Council to, you know, Mercy Corps? Has there been any, like, non-religious groups who have been pushing for a repeal of this that you know of?
You know, I'm sure there are some, but not that I know of. And it's worth pointing out, too, that even though this is being agitated for by some small religious groups, the vast majority of religious institutions in the United States, including churches and all other religious institutions, really value the nonpartisan communities that they're able to create without the divisiveness that politics introduces into their communities. I think really you need just look at the news to see how divided everything seems to be on partisan issues anymore. And churches and charities are really the last bastion of nonpartisan activity in the United States. And that needs to be protected and not put under threat.
What do you see right now as the likelihood of this happening?
You know what? I don't know. I think that, like I said, the majority of people that would be affected by this are right now opposed to it, and they should be. I think this is going to open charities and churches, which are institutions that Americans value and that are integral to our society and our democracy, and just open them to partisan manipulation in a way that we've never seen before, and that would be extremely harmful. And I think as soon as people start to be educated on how harmful that would be, they will oppose any changes. But that said, I think it's a real risk. There are some people that very strongly would like to use tax-deductible money to spend in elections, and I think you're going to hear those voices too.
I've been speaking with Emily Peterson-Kasson at Public Citizen. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
The American Association of Retired Persons, or AARP, is launching a campaign to ask Congress to protect Medicare. With help from the Oregon News Service, KBOO reporter Tom Flynn has more.
Even though President Trump promised during his campaign to protect Medicare, lawmakers in Congress are signaling they would like to make changes. In response, AARP is launching a campaign to protect the program, which serves more than 700,000 Oregonians. Medford President Don Bruland, a retiree with a pacemaker, recently replaced and covered by Medicare, is worried the voucher system proposed by members of Congress will leave his health insurance unaffordable.
It would be just impossible to get affordable insurance. And what I like to think of is that with this implant, I will be able to continue to volunteer in the community and be a part of my grandchildren's lives.
He says, especially for seniors on fixed incomes, the out-of-pocket costs left over in a voucher system would be too much. He's worried insurance companies under a voucher system may not be willing to cover his next pacemaker replacement. Jerry Cohen, director of AARP Oregon, says a voucher system would shift risks onto seniors. Whereas Medicare is a guaranteed set of benefits for everyone, the voucher system would defer to insurance companies, possibly leaving some seniors behind. He adds that Medicare is a benefit program to all Americans. That's important for more than 800,000 Oregonians who are 50 to 64, such as Cohen, and about to age into benefits.
Basically, this would really jack up my health care costs in the long run. So again, for those that say, well, I'm not on Medicare yet, I'm at even greater risk in terms of cost shifting.
Cohen says rising out-of-pocket costs already are a concern when it comes to both public and private health coverage, and that it could become worse under a voucher system. This is especially concerning for the 5% of Oregonians 65 and older who live under the poverty line. Bruland says Medicare has worked for him, but he's worried the next generation won't see the same benefits.
I want to make sure that my children and grandchildren have the same thing. In fact, I'm much more concerned about their futures and having a health care program than I am about my own.
For KBOO Evening News, with help from the Oregon News Service, this is Tom Flynn.
Oregon Zoo has its own winter-predicting rodent. Her name is Fufu. In the zoo's annual Hedgehog Days festivities, Fufu did not see her shadow this morning, indicating an early spring may be in store. Earlier today, Punxsutawney Phil, the Pennsylvania groundhog, said we were in for 6 more weeks of winter. Phil's predictions have been accurate about 39% of the time, zoo officials have said, while our homegrown rodents have close to a 50% success rate. Last year was Oregon's Hedgehog Velda predicted an early spring, and the state had the warmest February and April on record.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring music and conversations around organizing in Portland's Black African community. Tomorrow's weather will be cold and wet, with a high of 38 and low of 37. Freezing rain is likely in the early morning, so prepare and be careful on the roads if you must drive at all. Today in history marks the end, for better or worse, of a number of conflicts, including the Mexican-American War in 1848, the Estonian War of Independence in 1920, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1989. It also marks the final capture of German troops of the 6th Army in 1943, ending the Battle of Stalingrad, the costliest conventional battle in human history and a major turning point for World War II. Today is also the day that James Joyce's novel Ulysses was published in 1922, from which we get our quote of the day. "History," Stephen said, "is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake."
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here in America, the word fact has a straightforward, rather obvious meaning. Truth, reality, something that actually exists. But we now find ourselves transplanted to a new odd country, Trumplandia. Here, the factuality of known facts is being called into question by the highest civil authority in the land, the White House. In fact, with all truth suddenly open to presidential reinterpretation, can we really say with confidence that the White House is actually white? Consider the Donald's furious tweet in January, after actress Meryl Streep called him out for having mocked the physical disabilities of a reporter. "I never mocked a disabled reporter," he snapped, even though millions saw him on TV and videos doing exactly that. This inconvenient fact led Kellyanne Conway, Trump's official White House explainer, to castigate reporters for misinterpreting Donnie's reality. "You always want to go by what's coming out of his mouth rather than what's in his heart." Stranger yet, the Trumpster couldn't even control his convulsive ego on the solemn day of his inauguration. He claimed that the crowd he drew was the largest in history, despite obvious photographic and body count proof that his crowd was much smaller than the one drawn to Barack Obama's swearing-in. Enraged by this fact, His Majesty the President sent his sad sack press secretary to scold reporters, citing a mess of statistics meant to, quote, prove that Trump's crowd was the biggest ever. Unfortunately, those numbers were quickly shown to be false, i.e., lies. This embarrassment brought out Chief Explainer Conway again, insisting that the bogus numbers tossed out by the White House were not falsehoods, but, quote, alternative facts. Welcome to the alternative universe of Trumplandia. This is Jim Hightower saying, is it time for the next presidential election yet?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
President Donald J. Trump and his press secretary, Sean Spicer, apparently do not know that Frederick Douglass, the 19th century African-American abolitionist, is dead. Trump was doing most of the talking on Wednesday in what was to have been an African-American History Month listening session when he said, and I quote, "Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice." During a media briefing later in the day, White House spokesman Spicer was asked for clarity about what Trump meant by Douglass being recognized more. Spicer said, "I think he wants to highlight the contributions that he has made." He added that, "I think through a lot of the actions and statements that he's going to make, I think the contributions of Frederick Douglass will become more and more." Frederick Douglass has been dead for more than 120 years. He was born into slavery in Maryland in about 1818. His exact date of birth is unknown. He taught himself to read and write and escaped from slavery for the North in 1838. Douglass became an extraordinary orator. But in contrast to implications from comments from Trump and Spicer, Douglass is long dead, having passed away in 1895. In fact, next year will mark his 200th birthday. Social media had a field day following Trump's comments. One Twitter poster photoshopped Douglass into a photo of Trump and Spicer in the Oval Office. The great-great-great-grandson of Douglass told Yahoo News that his first reaction was to go on the attack and say, "I can't believe Trump doesn't know who Frederick Douglass is." But he decided to use the incident as a teaching moment instead. A Twitter account, at Real Frederick Douglass, posted tweets specifically in Trump's boastful manner of speech. One read, "Your fake national security immigrant ban goes against everything I stood for when I was alive 122 years ago. A horrible mess." Twitter took the account down in less than 24 hours for unspecified reasons.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham.
This is part of a wave of organizing that includes janitors, food service workers, shuttle drivers, but this is the single biggest victory that we've had in Silicon Valley and, you know, honestly, in private sector organizing in California.
SEIU Service Workers West Vice President Sanjay Garla, 3,000 security officers joined SEIU United Service Workers West in an effort to improve their wages and working conditions. They work for companies like Facebook and Cisco. The $12 to $20 an hour these security officers earn just isn't enough for a family to make it in the Silicon Valley. Garla says labor solidarity and unity drove this organizing victory.
The exciting thing here is that this was a real example of labor coming together across the board in California and around the country to support the campaign. And I hope that that kind of banding together and that kind of unity of focus can be replicated elsewhere so that we can have these types of groundbreaking victories.
In 2015, shuttle bus drivers transporting Facebook workers organized and saw salaries go from $18 an hour to $24.50. Republicans in Congress want to weaken the National Labor Relations Act. They want to amend it with a national so-called right-to-work bill introduced Wednesday. It attacks unions financially by outlawing union security clauses in collective bargaining agreements. Those clauses, voted on by workers at union shops, require workers covered by union contracts to pay dues or fees to support the collective bargaining efforts. Nobody gets forced to join a union. That's already illegal. What these right-to-work bills do is weaken unions by letting workers covered by union contracts withhold dues. These laws outlaw the democratic decisions made by workers to form unions and approve contracts that require dues be paid. Republican Representatives Joe Wilson of South Carolina and Steve King of Iowa are sponsoring the anti-union legislation. Some workers at Trump's Washington, D.C. hotel are joining Unite Here. Trump Las Vegas hotel workers had to fight a long battle against Trump to finally get the hotel to stop breaking labor law and bargain a contract there. The Washington Trump hotel workers are members of Unite Here Local 25, which represents 6,500 hotel workers in the District of Columbia.
Sponsored by Iron Workers Impact, now reserving spots for this year's groundbreaking conference, welcoming contractors to grow their business by networking and attending world-class breakouts. More on this event in San Diego, happening March 19th through the 22nd, is found online at impact-net.org under Events.
WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada. Online at atu.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
U.S. Congressman Jason Chaffetz, a Republican from Utah, announced via social media that he is backing out of a plan to sell 3.3 million acres of public land. "I'm a proud gun owner, hunter, and love our public lands," reads Chaffetz's post made last night on Instagram. Hunters have been among the strongest voices opposing the sale of public lands since the game they hunt relies on open wilderness to survive. Chaffetz blamed a 1997 report from Bill Clinton's administration for deeming the land disposable, though Chaffetz himself is the one who introduced the bill to sell the land in 2011 and then reintroduced it last month.
President Donald Trump announced Judge Neil Gorsuch as his pick to fill the vacant seat on the Supreme Court bench. As expected, the nominee is staunchly opposed to abortion. Gorsuch ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby in its ultimately successful case to not have to pay for employee contraception methods mandated in the Affordable Care Act. He's also supported efforts to defund Planned Parenthood. While the empty seat on the Supreme Court bench may be the single most significant appointment regarding the future of reproductive rights in the United States, legislative efforts are also underway. On Monday, Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa filed legislation aimed at preventing Planned Parenthood from receiving any federal funding. The two bills are a sequel to similar past proposed laws, but this time the Republican-controlled Senate has the support of the executive branch. Reporter Lena Nozizwe of Free Speech Radio News has been listening as a divided country speaks out on abortion from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles.
Her body, her choice. 44
years after the U.S. Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade legalized abortion around the country, the landmark case is in the crosshairs of an empowered Republican Party that also seeks to cut off government funding for Planned Parenthood. The Trump administration has promised to accomplish both despite popular opposition. A 2016 Pew Research Center survey found pro-choice support was at a two-decade high, with 57% of those polled saying that abortion should be legal in most or all cases, while 39% said it should be illegal in all or most cases.
Pro.
Pro.
The country's anti-abortion and pro-choice division has been loud and clear throughout the new administration's first days. Trump's pick for vice president sent a clear message that choice, when it comes to reproductive rights, would be an early target. Last week, Pence became the first sitting vice president to speak at the annual anti-abortion March for Life in Washington, D.C.
That's why this administration will work with the Congress to end taxpayer funding of abortion and abortion providers. And we will devote those resources to health care services for women across America.
A clear jab at Planned Parenthood, which provides both health care services eligible for Medicaid reimbursements and abortions. Republicans like Pence accuse Planned Parenthood of using federal funds for abortions, something prohibited by the Hyde Amendment, except in cases of rape, incest, or danger to the life of the pregnant woman.
We've been part of the American country, the fabric of America, for 100 years, and my pledge today is our doors stay open.
Cecile Richards, the president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, took the stage at another march earlier this year, the Women's March on Washington.
We're not going to take this lying down. And we will not go back.
The organization says abortions make up only 3% of its total services. The 97% include cancer screenings, testing for sexually transmitted diseases, and other health services for women, including contraception.
You know, I get my birth control from Planned Parenthood, so I love it.
Casey, who asked to be identified by her first name only, is one of almost 5 million women around the world Planned Parenthood serves each year. In past attempts to defund the health care provider, Republican lawmakers and anti-abortion lobbyists have suggested a network of community clinics could replace the Medicaid-funded services currently performed by Planned Parenthood. The nationwide women's marches brought together a coalition of causes, but support for Planned Parenthood is one of the reasons Casey took part in the L.A. demonstration.
So I think Planned Parenthood's a beautiful thing, and it gives a lot of people that can't afford it, that don't have insurance, options, whether it goes abortion, whether it goes birth control. Like, leave people alone. You know what I mean? Let it be a choice. It's a choice. People talk about transients being on the street and welfare and all that other stuff. It's not everybody should bring babies into the world that aren't ready to have some babies. You know what I mean?
The new president has already signed an executive order reinstating the Mexico City policy that blocks federal funding for international NGOs that provide clients with abortion counseling or referrals. The policy, also known as the Global Gag Rule, dates back to the Ronald Reagan administration and has been instated and revoked depending on which party is in office.
We are the pro-life generation!
Both the Women's March on Washington and the March for Life drew crowds larger than what organizers say they expected. Now both sides of the abortion issue watch two men who will hold decisive power over women's reproductive choices, one with a pen to sign executive orders and the other whose vote will swing the Supreme Court. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn, Tony Lutigra, and me, Miriam Widman. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends and Free Speech Radio News. You can find original content at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is not Lisa Loving. It's Charity. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, guest host Linda Olson Osterlund talks to Portland lawyer Tom Nelson about Trump's Muslim ban and the legal battle to overturn it. At 9, Pacific Underground discusses the effect of the immigration order on Asian and Pacific Islander communities. Plus, a look back at problematic pop culture favorites like Short Round and The Karate Kid. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, a Radio Geekly continues its multi-part series on gatekeeping and the oppression of people of color in geek culture. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking donate. Night, Miriam.
Night, Chris.
Good night. Matt.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Oregon State Legislature began its regular 2017 session yesterday. While transportation planning, modernization, and funding are major issues in the session, one bill in particular is focused on Oregon's shipping systems. Senate Bill 530, aka the Oregon Trade and Container Shipping Development Act, is sponsored by Republican Senator Brian Boquist of Dallas and is currently referred to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, as well as Joint Ways and Means. No meetings or hearings on the bill have been scheduled yet. Boquist introduced the bill at the request of the Oregon Shipping Group, which is directed by Salem lawyer, lobbyist,